Bon, c'est prêt, du coup.
Okay. So we can start. I'll start this. I'm so happy actually to start this series on complexity. So this was supposed to take place in Lyon a year ago in March 2020. Okay. And well, we had to adapt, of course, as every scholar had to do. And this is a good, let's be optimistic and see the nice side of the thing is that much better for the climate. Okay. So we spent a lot less energy, emitted less dioxide, I mean carbon dioxide. So we are happy to meet on the on the platform. That's it. And I just wanted to briefly welcome everyone. So we are happy to have you all here, and especially, of course, Andy Pickering, that was supposed to come to Lyon to a nice restaurant, but he is not so happy to be on the web. But that thanks him to accept to be here virtually, and so we can discuss his very important paper to start the series. And I'll just briefly present the forthcoming, I mean, the program. So we decided to meet every Monday morning for the next 2 months or so. And we maybe, if we receive more suggestions, we can actually, I mean, go,
Extend.
yes, to extend to several Mondays if we receive interesting communications. So just don't hesitate to propose communication, and we can add one or two more Mondays. I wanted to warn everyone that this is actually recorded because several people couldn't be here or wanted to have the whole series available. So it's been recorded, and we'll put a link on the report on the same page, on the same web page. And then actually, well, I can't share my screen anymore. So maybe Fabrizio, now you have you can maybe share your screen for the program, because if we want just to show people, I mean, more or less what is coming in the next Mondays. I mean, of course.
You want me to put you as an administrator again?
No, just if you open the page of the seminar,
Ah, okay.
you can just very briefly, because I wanted to use that very briefly to present,
Okay.
to show the different aspects of
Yes.
complexity we are going to present.
Yes. Here you
Okay,
go.
yeah.
So you see?
Yep, great.
Okay. I go down to the
Yeah,
problem.
that's it. Okay. So after the of course today we have this introduction, and we discuss this cybernetics and wicked problems by Andy Pickering. And I mean, it's just to show the diversity, partly coming of course from Fabrizio's PhD, who really made a lot of interviews, and I mean he reviewed the field, this very heterogeneous field of complexity. So we are really leaning heavily on his work on his PhD. That's Thomas Turnbull and Jean-Pierre Dupuis on the second cybernetics and the links between cybernetics and complexity that we are already, of course, we are going to deal with this link with Andy today, of course. And then I'll just stop I mean, the next Monday on January 25th, we are going to explore the link between complexity and business, because this is an important link. Santa Fe is proud to try to link also complexity to business. And we are going to approach this by in two ways. One, by a practitioner of the link, because it's Michel Morvan is the former director of the Complexity Institute here in Lyon, and he is now the director of a business, a big business, a lot, I mean, something like 50 employees on applying complexity research into different businesses. So he's going to show us how he did that. And on a more reflective maybe stance. David Wallach is a professor of organization studies, and he is also a specialist of complex thinking, more in the social sciences, from the social science perspective. Okay? But we'll have many, many other topics, including complexities in physics or modeling the environment and the algorithms and big data, etc., etc. So please stay tuned, and we'll have many exciting Mondays in the forthcoming weeks. Okay, so I think it's enough for the presentation. So maybe Fabrizio, you can start to give more or less a first idea of the landscape of complexity, okay? And then we will have Andy, and we'll leave at least a half an hour for discussion, okay? So the idea here is really to have a very informal and open discussion. So, okay, let's start. And you have this pleasure of starting, Fabrizio.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being there. Everybody can see my slides? Do you see the slides, Pablo?
Yeah, I see. Yeah. But everyone has, I mean, I
okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, just to check. Okay, I will present today the first chapter of my thesis. Because actually, theories of complexity, as our seminar shows, are many and very different ones. So the very first question that I tried to answer in the first chapter of my thesis, which was sort of a synthesis and confirmation of what I had done in a preliminary way during the master time, was what do we mean when we talk about complexity? So the outline of my speech, which is going to be very short, is to just contextualize my two interventions, because the first one, the short one is today, and there is another one that I will give in three or four sessions. Then I will present the seven theories of complexity that I have described in my thesis, and then just a quick slide to explain why the rest of my thesis was dedicated to complexity sciences, which is one of the different theories of complexity. So to very quickly present my thesis in two words. Basically, my thesis was in three parts, an historical, an epistemological, and a sociological part. The historical part, part of the historical part will be presented today for the taxonomy of complexity theories. And then all the rest of the thesis was dedicated to complex system sciences or complexity sciences. And about them, I focused on probably the most important institute that launched it didn't create the label and the community of complexity sciences, but it somehow launched the community, the organization, the structuring of the community on the American level and on the international level, which is the Santa Fe Institute, which is in Santa Fe in New Mexico, and which was founded in 1984. And on the Institut du Système Complexe Paris-Île-de-France in Paris, we will have David Chavalarias, who is the director of the institute, will also interview in this seminar. Then I have also an epistemological part, where the heart of the part is the description of the way scientists argue the credibility of their research. Because complexity sciences make a lot of usage of computational tools, so simulation studies is a big interdisciplinary field, which is quite intriguing, and I wanted to contribute to that. And the sociological part was basically in three subparts. First, the description of complexity science as a community, which is precisely not precisely a discipline, nor an interdiscipline, nor a specialty, which is a synonym of sub-discipline. So I tried to understand what was the best way to sociologically describe and characterize complexity science. So this part will be soon published on the European Journal of Science and Technology Science Studies. So it's called Complexity Science, a Scientific Platform. Then I also described the different kinds of interdisciplinary work that I could observe within this community, and then the epistemic engagements, which gives the title to the seminar, and which I will present in the next time. I mean, I don't remember anymore. The 1st of February, I think. So why to talk about theories of complexity? This is the next slide. Sorry. No, first of all, what is the starting point? The starting point is that if you ask people, even the le grand public, the general public, not only scholars, if you ask people what complexity is, each one will tend to give a different answer. To identify complexity to one single name or a group of people or an institution. So people will be able to say Niklas Luhmann, Edgar Morin, the Santa Fe Institute, Barabaji, etc. The question that one can ask, of course, is who is right? So my approach was socio-historical and not normative. So I try not to establish who has got the right to use that that word. I just described all the people that use complexity or complex system as a sort of a label to federate a community around it. So just a quick reminder about the etymology of the term. So a complex today is almost a synonym of difficult or complicated, but actually the etymology of the term suggests the characteristics of interdependence and irreductibility of something which is characterized as complex. And so all the theories of complexity don't employ the term in the common and banal way, but in the etymological way, even if not all theories of complexity thematize or publish things about the etymology, but they are aware of the original meaning of the term. So why to choose the general term of theories of complexity? Because theory can refer as much to a philosophical doctrine, like, for example, Edgar Morin's complexity thought, as to a science, like complexity sciences. And complexity can refer both to the philosophical discourse about the concept in general and to complex systems in particular. When you search for texts that have to somehow describe or do the same exercise that I'm doing today, trying to put some order or to offer some kind of taxonomy of the different complexity theories, you normally find four attitudes. I described the four attitudes. One is the renunciation. Some authors give it up to the exercise of classifying finding different groups or subgroups within complexity. But the problem is that these authors, like Seth Lloyd or Nicola Rescher, who is an American philosopher, don't even try, actually, because actually they don't even are sociologists or historians, so they are more philosophers or complexity theorists themselves, like Seth Lloyd, who is a physicist. So they don't really search for a set of criteria through which trying to establish this perimeter. Another attitude is the ironical view. For example, Ralph Abraham, who is a mathematician from chaos theory, from dynamical systems, who tends to basically consider as if it was just one thing, different theories. Different theories like cybernetics, systemics, and chaos theory, which have different tools, different definitions, different communities. Ralph Abraham considered them as being part of one single movement. What else? The reductionist view can consist in and this is typical of popular texts, either books or articles on popular scientific magazines, like La Recherche in France or similar, who may tend to reduce the entire complexity to just one actor. And then you have the internalist views who have some kind of normative or epistemological approach in which some and not all of the theories are considered, and they are hierarchized. Yeah. So to say that, for example, Edgar Morin has an article in which he distinguishes between general and restricted complexities. And the idea is to say that a restricted complexity, which is the name he gives to the complexity science strain from the Santa Fe, his concept is to say that restricted complexity didn't make the big leap in order to really reflect about complexity in general, which is the task of the general complexity, which is what it does. So my approach was to find a set of criteria in, first of all, to establish the big perimeter of complexity theories, because complexity is a term which is used in many fields and in many more fields than those that I'm gonna talk about in a minute. But if I detected seven groups, it's because these seven groups have these characteristics. First of all, they constitute a community which uses complexity as a federator label and with an epistemic project. The second criterion is the promise that with this new theories and tools around the complexity concept or complex systems is that they can achieve epistemic or political goals for science or for society. And then they have to dispose about some meeting spaces. More in details, in my chapter, which will be published soon as a book. With Edition Matériologique, probably during this year. So I describe each group. For each group, I describe the common references that they use, the main representatives of these communities. The shared definition of complexity or of complex systems, the shared tools and approaches that these communities share, the epistemic project and the promises, and the meeting spaces. So, Pablo, how much time do we have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. Because
we want to know which these seven.
Yes.
Yeah. At least briefly, just to have. We need to know what you mean by these seven theories briefly. And okay.
Maybe
we will say on which if he identifies with one of these and how and etc. Okay. But let's. Yes.
Perfect.
Dwarfs, yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I just wanted to add before I forget it that all this work was done especially through qualitative methods, and I mean mainly through qualitative methods, and with Floriana Gargiulo, who is a mathematician who will intervene in the seminar. We are trying to test this my work through quantitative and scientometric tools. But just to say that. So the first group, I call it the cyber systemic archipel, because it gathers all the people who share as a common reference the text of cybernetics and systemics, which are two scientific movements from the 40s, which use the term of complexity themselves, but they don't use complex system or complexity as a federator label, at least in my opinion, to federate their community. Precisely, they use the concept of cybernetics or systemics in order to federate their community. In France, the main representative was the Groupe de 10, the group of 10, which actually was around 20 people, who gathered at the end of the 60s until the 76 at the house of one of their members, Jacques Robin. And some of the members were, among the members, you have Henri Atlan, but also Edgar Morin, also Jean-Pierre Dupuis, who will intervene into this seminar. So these people gather together in order to develop for social sciences a new paradigm to overcome the dominant paradigm of the time, of the epoch, of the age, which was structuralism. And for life sciences, they wanted to contest, to criticize somehow the dominant paradigm coming from genetics, which uses a lot the metaphor, which became a real metaphysics of the information code. So the definition that they have is of complex systems is as ensembles which are self-organized, recursive, and emergent, and the main tools are conceptuals, and the main tools are the positive and negative feedback, but many more, of course. This is an extreme synthesis of very complex and heterogeneous communities and theories, which are heterogeneous in themselves. Not only the theories of complexity in general are heterogeneous, but each one of this community has a lot of heterogeneity inside each one of them. The second group is what I call the dynamical systems archipel, among which you can find precisely the Santa Fe Institute stream, but you also have the Ilya Prigogine's school, but also Hermann Haken's school, etc. The references that that they share is dynamical system theory, which is a very old body of theories and mathematics from the end of the 19th century, which received a strong boost around the 60s and 70s, thanks to what now we call chaos theory. The definition of complex systems, it's again as ensembles which are self-organized, evolving. So the accent is on Darwinism and emergent. Tools are especially mathematics from dynamical systems and digital tools like agent-based modeling, network theory, cellular automata, and many more. The general project is to formalize soft sciences and better predict complex systems, also for policy. So, for example, computational epidemiology, that today was actually some of the computational epidemiologists connected to complex systems community, and it is because of them that the lockdown was taken into account by politicians in Europe as a serious solution in order to avoid a lot of casualties. I don't know how to say, dead people. And the meetings places are especially complexity institutes. Also, the European and now world society for complex systems is quite strong and active, but academic journals on complex systems are rarer and less invested than disciplinary journals by by the members of this community. Then you have computational complexity. I will go faster with the other ones because otherwise it's too much. So computational complexity, it's not the same thing as Kolmogorov complexity, which is my fourth group. At the beginning, I tended to conflate them, but they actually have different communities and different concepts and different tools. So computational complexity is probably the most famous tool is the P equal NP problems. There is a very big community worldwide which gathers around the Conference on Computational Complexity, which has existed since the mid-80s. While the Kolmogorov complexity is much more a much smaller community, which is mostly active in France and in some American institutions, and they actually don't have institutes specialized in that on that or even journals specialized on that. So you find these people generally meet informally at university departments of logics and computer science. Then you have integrative complexity, which is a group, again, a small group, but very productive from some North American universities. It's a community in psychology. These psychologists try to provide tools in order to analyze the complexity of a discourse of an individual with many applications. Less therapeutic than management or policy. So, for example, one of the main representatives of this group, psychologist Peter Sudfeld, who is now at the University of British Columbia, for example, he works a lot on the integrative complexity of political discourses. Then you have a sixth group in engineering. So it's systems engineering. There you have it's a community which is mostly active in the North America and UK. In France, there are some actors that I interviewed, especially Daniel Krob, who is both a professor at Polytechnique and an entrepreneur. And their objective is to find a sort of a meta model in order to produce basically any kind of industrial product in the best efficient way and not through the trial and error approach. And the seventh and last group is what I call the complex adaptive systems in medicine, because their references are other theories of complexity, the first and the second that I described so far. So especially they refer to Edgar Morin's works and to the Santa Fe Institute works. And the representatives are especially some Australian doctors who founded and launched this community around a regular conference and also sort of a section of a journal. So the section was called the Forum on Systems and Complexity in Medicine and Healthcare, and the journal which hosted this forum was called Journal of Evaluation in Clinical Practice. And so their approach is half philosophical, half mathematical, in order to build a different non-reductionist approach for health professionals, both administrators, doctors, or even educators. That's pretty much it. I will finish my presentation by just saying why I've chosen to focus the rest of my thesis on only one of these theories, even if all of them are interesting for different reasons. I decided to focus on complexity sciences from the dynamical systems archipel because they are the most internationally spread. They are basically everywhere in the world. There is a nice article from Stefan Wolfram blog, which offers a first cartography, a first map of the complexity institutes in the world. They are basically everywhere except Africa, unluckily. They are also the most known through media and popular texts, especially in English. There are a lot of popular texts about complexity, this strain of complexity. The most famous one is the book by Mitchell Waldrop, which is just called Complexity. Because also they are the most institutionally anchored and funded, from 2005 to 2015, there were a lot of funding, for example, in Europe, coming, for example, from the European Commission, into the direction of the study of complex systems, and also because they are the most influential both on the scientific and the cultural levels. Because, for example, you can consider that some of the main keywords of complexity sciences are today extremely known even by the general public, like tipping points, like emergence, like networks, etc. That's basically my reasons for studying this field, and thank you for your attention. And now the floor is to Andrew.
Yeah, let me just thanks a lot, Fabrizio.
I hope it was clear.
Stop your sharing your screen so that we can see Andy. And yeah, I'm just bridging your two interventions. I actually wanted to thank also the Complex System Institute in Lyon for financial support that we actually didn't use. But anyway, I mean, we granted some financial support for travel, et cetera, et cetera.
And food.
Thank ICSI, I mean, the Lyon Complex System Institute. And thanks, Fabrizio. I think it was important to start with your work because you really wanted to investigate empirically this. I mean, what people did with this concept of complexity, which is actually very fuzzy, as a concept. Okay, so it's important to describe empirically what people are doing. I mean, science in action around complexity is food for discussion for the whole series of the seminar, because the concept itself is really fuzzy. Actually, Jean-Marc Lévy-Leblanc will be with us in a few. I mean, he's here, but he will talk on the NRIMA in March, saying that the notion of complexity is ultimately a mirage, like all the more frequent in the deserts of thought, which is not a very nice description of complexity. But I mean, I share this definition at some to some extent. Or you could also say that it's an umbrella concept. This complexity is an umbrella concept as artificial intelligence. You know, I mean, some people say that artificial intelligence is an umbrella concept that is used actually by companies to exploit public confusion, slapping under the artificial intelligence label whatever they are selling because of some genuine progresses, okay, in problems. So, I mean, maybe, I mean, the concept is fuzzy, so it's important to start empirically. And it's also important to start with some historical examples. I had read, and I had invited Andy Pickering in Lyon in those times where we could travel to present his important work on the English cybernetics, which is actually different from, I mean, I realized that reading his book, that English cybernetics had this distinct flavor from Wiener and US cybernetics, which was characterized by Philip Mirofsky, as far as I remember, like a life science useful for as a science of death, the US cybernetics, you know? And clearly Andy showed that English cybernetics was not that, I mean, similar, and the examples he will deal in, I mean, with not too much detail today, but the work by Stafford Beer, by Pask, in psychiatry. I mean, this more symmetrical science was very, very interesting. And I'm happy that he followed his work on this, on more present examples like that he's going to present today, so that we can judge the political relevance. I think that this is, to me, this is the most important aspect of the whole seminar, is what, I mean, for what complexity is useful or not today, and what's the political relevance of complexity theories, complexity institutes, complexity science for the today's world. So I'm so happy that Andy has accepted to present his talk today. So you have half an hour, more or less, Andy, or a little less, and then we have some time for discussion. So. Yep.
Okay.
So do we see Andy? Yes. Okay. So maybe you can shut down your camera too, Fabrizio, so we only see Andy. Okay.
Right. Is this working okay now?
Yeah. Perfect.
My screen looks peculiar, but it doesn't matter. All right. Well, thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to be here. It was great when here meant Lyon. I'd have loved to come back to France for this meeting instead of sitting in the attic of my house in England. But at least we're doing our best for climate change, as Pablo said.
Yeah.
So my paper for this meeting I wrote in advance. It's online at the conference website. You can read it if you like. The title has varied with time. Today, I think it's called Wicked Problems and the Cybernetic Method. I'm not sure how it fits in with the overall trajectory of this conference, but we can find out.
Yeah, we'll find, don't worry.
Right. So my thinking on complexity comes from my interest in the history of cybernetics and the work, as Pablo said, of people like Ross Ashby, Gregory Bates, and Stafford Beer and Gordon Pass. Beer distinguished between three kinds of system in the world, which he called simple, complex, and exceedingly complex. And according to Beer, simple and complex systems can be understood by the methods of the standard sciences, operations, research, and things like that. But exceedingly complex systems are different, according to him. They're resistant to such approaches. Because of their sheer complexity, and because they're liable to change unpredictably, that our existing knowledge of them is continually going out of date. And Beer's examples of exceedingly complex systems, the usual ones are the brain, the firm, and the economy. And cybernetics, for Beer, was the science of these things that he called exceedingly complex systems, or wicked systems, to give them another name, as Horst Rittel called them, a long time ago now, in the 1960s, I think. So cybernetics was the science of exceedingly complex or wicked systems. As such, cybernetics didn't aim to understand wicked systems from the inside, say, by modeling them mathematically. That wasn't what cybernetics was primarily about. Instead, the central concern of this branch of cybernetics was how to get to grips, whatever that means, with wicked systems from the outside, so to speak. The problematic was how to get along and adapt to wicked systems. And that's what my paper for this meeting is about. So to be straight, and just to emphasize, I'm not interested today in conceptualizing the inner workings of wicked systems. So my approach and my topic differs from Fabrizio's, for example, his review of ways of understanding complex systems from the inside. And my approach probably differs from the later papers too. I'm interested in how we interact with the sorts of wicked systems we continually run into and struggle with in the world. How do we get along with them? Global warming is an often mentioned example of a wicked system, though I have to say I've got no solution to the problem of global warming today. Okay, I'll have a mouthful of coffee. In a sense, almost by definition, the work of the cyberneticians already addresses the question of living with wicked problems. That's what cybernetics was about, according to Beer. And I've written about examples of how that goes in my book, The Cybernetic Brain. But here I want to follow a rather different approach in order, A, to speak about a new topic, the environment, which didn't figure in my earlier studies of cybernetics, and B, to bring out what I take to be the key features of what Gordon Pask called the cybernetic method. What is the cybernetic method, is my question. I want to get clear on what I think the cybernetic method is and how it differs from the scientific method. And I want to understand the contrast between them as a paradigm shift in our ways of relating to the world, a shift from acting on to acting with nature, from enframing to poesis, in Heidegger's terms. But before I get to that, we need an example to think about. So I want to talk about a real-world wicked problem and how it's been solved in practice. And there's more on this in the paper online. So, my example concerns the Colorado River, which flows through the Grand Canyon in the west of the United States. In 1963, a giant dam, the Glen Canyon Dam, was completed on the Colorado upstream of the Grand Canyon. And this set in motion many unexpected downstream transformations of the Colorado ecosystem. Things started to change unexpectedly and unpredictably. Sandbanks eroded, native species of plants and fish became endangered. Alien species started to move into the Colorado ecosystem. The problem of what to do about these transformations and how to reverse them is my paradigmatic wicked problem today. Wicked in the sense that no one knew how to address it a priori. You couldn't calculate it, for example. And also in the sense that any attempt to address it was liable to change the problem itself in modifying the river. Okay, that's the problem. The sequence of events that interests the solution of this problem began by chance. In 1983, Lake Powell, upstream of the dam, was in danger of overflowing, and as an emergency measure, vast quantities of water were released through the dam to lower the level of the lake. And it was noticed that this artificial flooding of the river had unexpected but beneficial effects downstream. Quote, depleted beaches were replenished, exotic vegetation was killed along the riverbanks, and previously degraded animal habitats were recreated. End of quote. And encouraged by this, the dam operators embarked on what became known as the Glen Canyon Dam Adaptive Management Program, or AMP, as I'll call it for short, the Adaptive Management Program. This centered this program, the AMP, on a sequence of artificial floods on the Colorado River, deliberately released from the dam, each aiming to learn from the others in terms of operating conditions. How much water should be released and when, and so on. 8 floods have so far been conducted since 1996. The early floods looked promising. Sandbanks built up again and invasive species disappeared. But these effects wore off with time as the sandbanks eroded again and invasive plants re-emerged from the mud. However, this process in turn served to focus attention on sediment carried along by the river. The Glen Canyon Dam slowed the Colorado River down, leading it to deposit most of its sediment above the dam. And the conviction arose that it was a lack of sediment that caused the problems below the dam. And the idea that then came up, after the second artificial flood, was that perhaps the sediment carried by 2 other rivers that joined the Colorado below the dam, the Paria and Little Colorado rivers, could be exploited. In particular, the idea was to wait until one or the other of these rivers was in flood and thus carrying much more sediment than usual, and then to stage a flood on the Colorado to carry this added sediment downstream, possibly recreating the sandbars and rejuvenating the ecosystem. More experimentation followed, leading eventually to a recognition in 2014 that artificial floods, quote, timed to follow sand inputs from floods on the Paria and Little Colorado rivers, are in fact an effective sandbar building strategy, end of quote. The sandbars continue to fade away between floods, and the current wisdom is now that there need to be relatively frequent artificial floods on the Colorado synchronized with major sediment inputs from the Paria and the Little Colorado. And these artificial floods are now, in fact, routinely seen as helping to, quote, rebuild beaches, sandbars, and other environmental resources. And that's my example. According to me, the wicked problem of ecological degradation on the Colorado River has, in effect, been solved by this strategy of synchronizing artificial and natural floods on the three different rivers I've been talking about. We have successfully got to grips with one of Stafford Beer's exceedingly complex systems. We've done it. So we can think of the AMP and its artificial floods as exemplifying what Gordon Pask called the cybernetic method. If we want to visualize what the cybernetic method of acting in the world is, think about the AMP. And I want to draw attention in the rest of my paper to some of the main features of the cybernetic method now. First, let's think about the contrast between the scientific method and the cybernetic method. The scientific method isn't a precisely defined thing, but it centers somehow on knowledge. A standard story is that it entails formulating and testing hypotheses about nature. In the case of complex systems, it might also entail constructing conceptual models of their inner workings. And from this angle, the interesting thing about the cybernetic method is that it doesn't center on knowledge at all. The basic structure of the AMP, its skeleton, was not cognitive or epistemic. The AMP centered instead on action, performance, doing things. The dam operators did something. They opened the valves to release large quantities of water through the Glen Canyon Dam. The downstream ecosystem did something in response to that. The sandbanks grew, etc. The dam operators reacted to that by doing something else, modifying the timing and the volume of floods, and so on, in a back and forth of the human and the non-human that I call a dance of agents. And this, I think, is the key contrast between the scientific and the cybernetic methods. In science, knowledge comes to the fore. In cybernetics, knowledge recedes into the background, and instead action, performance, agency, and the dance of agency, as I call it, take center stage. We could think here of a gestalt switch, of foreground and background between these two paradigms, science and cybernetics, or in framing and poesis, as Heidegger called them. And I think it's worth noting first that the scientific paradigm obviously dominates our culture today. We always look to science to solve the world's problems. And we're trying to produce scientists when we emphasize so-called STEM subjects in education, science, technology, engineering, medicine. We say these are the important things that students learn in schools and universities. And second, though I feel a bit scared to say it out loud, science is actually pretty useless when it comes to wicked problems, which most of our important problems are. That's the whole point about wicked problems. What we need instead is the cybernetic method of open-ended, performative experimentation, the existence of which is hard even to express in everyday or academic language, which is why I just had to run through a lengthy example. And that's the main point I wanted to make today. Thinking about getting to grips with complex systems points us to a paradigm shift in how we stand and act in the world, from science as knowledge to cybernetics and dances of agency. And I could just mention one further aspect of that shift. Reading contemporary accounts of the evolution of the AMP, a tone of regret becomes obvious, a kind of sadness. Improvements have been made, but only temporarily, between floods. And between floods, the river regresses towards its prior state, and that's not really what we want. And the counterpart to this regret is the dream of a final solution, a one-off operation that would restore the Colorado ecosystem once and for all. Just like building a dam, say, is a one-off solution to the problem of containing water and generating electricity. This dream of dominating and enframing nature is an integral part of the modern scientific paradigm, which comes so naturally to us all. In contrast, the achievement of the AMP by the AMP is not a one-off finished mastery of nature, but what I would call a choreography of agency, tuning the human agency of the dam operators into the non-human agency of the Colorado, Little Colorado, and Paria rivers, and of the downstream ecosystem in a kind of continuing process, such that the state of the ecosystem varies around a more or less desirable balance point. In this sense, we can think of the AMP as a process of learning, as I said, to act with rather than on nature, poesis rather than enframing. Again, it's not clear to me that modern engineering or modern common sense has any image, even a word, for this sort of choreography of the human and the non-human, this tuning together. Hence the persistence of regret around the AMP. In this sense, too, thinking about complex systems points us to a paradigm shift in our stance in the world. Now, from domination to cooperation, from mastery to reciprocal coupling. And that's basically where I wanted to get to this morning. This idea that thinking about complex systems, especially exceedingly complex, wicked systems, can move us into a new paradigmatic space that foregrounds agency and performance rather than cognition and science, acting with nature instead of acting on it. The written version of my paper online also includes more discussions of different versions of the cybernetic method and an argument against second order cybernetics's emphasis on language. There are also bits of an argument with Horst Rittel and Melvin Weber about wicked systems and what they are. And there's a discussion of the social aspects of the cybernetic method. But I'm going to end there. We can possibly talk about those in the discussion, if you like. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot, Andy, for your presentation. And we just left 30 minutes for discussion. So Please, I'll ask the, I have the privilege of being the organizer, so I'll ask the first two questions, but then I will ask everyone, if possible, to use the chat to raise your hand in some sense, if you want to contribute to the discussion. Possibly saying, I mean, what the topic roughly of your point that you want to raise, so that I can try to organize the discussion, because half an hour will be very short. So please just tell in a few words what you want to discuss, I mean, the topic, so that I can try to organize a little bit of the discussion. But I have, I mean, I think that it's a very stimulating work, and especially on a very essential point for our future. I mean, I've been very concerned about the let's say, the ecological catastrophe, to say it in these words. So it's an essential point, I feel, for our future. So how we are going to deal with this this forthcoming catastrophe? So are we going to try some technological fix, like geoengineering, for example? This would be, I guess, your modernist approach, the techno-scientific, or a more reciprocal or symmetrical stance and a different point of view, I mean, a more poietic point of view. So I think that this is very, very important. However, I mean, so it's stimulating, but I have raises many, many exciting questions from a more intellectual point of view. And the first discussion I think we should have is about your central distinction between enframing and poiesis, I mean, or acting on, acting with, or a cybernetic or scientific method. Okay, this is like the core conceptual issue, I feel. And I should say actually that you were kind enough to send me one chapter of your forthcoming book, and this chapter deals with how Aborigines use fire to deal with, like, the environment, which is maybe not the best word, but I mean how they use fire. And I think that this example is also very clear to understand this difference, okay, what you mean by this difference between using fire to control things or just to deal in a more, yeah, I mean, it's different. I mean, we lack the words, I agree, okay? Different way. So I recommend in advance this, I mean, your forthcoming book. Is there a title actually, Andy, on that book or not?
What is it? What's the current title? At one stage it was called Doing Without Science, but now it's probably called something like Acting with Nature, subtitle, okay. Doing Without Science, maybe that.
Okay. So my first point is, when I hear your presentation, I feel that there is a strong similarity between how you deal with poiesis, I mean, what you describe as the poiesis, and the very process of research of usual science before you find the island of stability. Actually, your former work was saying that even particle physics, you follow basically the same process. You try this and you try that, etc. And but somehow at some stage you find this island of stability which you cannot predict, and then you stop, and this is science and this is knowledge, etc. So maybe you should correct me, but when I hear what you say, I think that actually, instead of what you say in your paper, that performative experimentation is in a different space from science, a heretical paradigm, I would say, I mean, to provoke discussion, that is actually the same paradigm. There's nothing heretical here. It's just the same process. The only difference is that in one case, you eventually find this island of stability, and then you call that science knowledge, and you can use that knowledge of the island of stability and build some science. And in other cases, you don't find this island of stability, maybe for ontological reasons, I don't know, I mean, but okay, you don't. And then, okay, this is, and then you call that poiesis. Mm. And that's the only difference, okay, to mark this contrast. So is poiesis becoming suddenly science once you find this island of stability, because then representation become efficient? Or is there a strong difference? Maybe we can start with that, and then I'll ask my second question.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question, Pablo. The answer is a bit complicated, which is why, you know, I find myself trying to write a book to explain what I'm thinking about here. So, you know, I mean, what I've just been saying, this idea of being in the world by staging dances of agency with it, actually grows out of my work in history of science a very long time ago. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I wrote up in my book, The Mangle of Practice, in 1995. So scientists, like everybody else, the only way to find out about the world is to stage these dances of agency. The funny thing is, well, not funny, but modern science and modern engineering impose a certain kind of a structure on the dance of agency. They insist that this dance is going to end when you reach a kind of dualist configuration, when, say, human beings are in command of a machine. Like one of my early case studies was the history of the bubble chamber. So there's a lot of back and forth between the scientist and his apparatus until he's produced a kind of docile machine, the bubble chamber, which serves the will of the human scientist. So the kind of telos, the definitive aim of science or engineering is to make the world dual, put us in command of it. And that can happen, right? You know, so these dances of agency can lead to that kind of domination. After I wrote The Mangle of Practice, I started to be interested in what would it be like if we didn't insist that our ways of going on in the world made the world more dual, to put us in command of it. And that led me, well, it led me to cybernetics. There's a whole range of examples of non-dualist ways of being in the world, which are interestingly different from scientific ways of being in the world, which I find kind of politically attractive. You know? So then, that's my answer.
Okay, so then, just having a look also on the chat, but I would like, I think that it's an important point, because so is the exploration similar, and then only the result is different between poiesis and science, or is also the exploration different because we have a different idea as an eventual end in mind, like this mechanistic control that we would have in science, but not in getting along with or in this poietic. So the exploration would be different or not. I mean, this would be an interesting point. Is the process, is this dance? So are we dancing different dances? Are we dancing tango and twist? So I don't know. Or are, I mean, that would be interesting to try to characterize more finally the dance. Is that exactly the same thing, or at what level is it's the same, because we just have to find out? I mean, I agree that we can, but is there some difference at any level that allows, because otherwise it seems like just at the two are different just at the end, but not during the process. And this is,
well, right, I mean, it might help to make this distinction that Bruno Latour made many years ago between science in the making, mm-hmm. and finished science. Mm-hmm. So science in the making, genuine research, has to be staging performative experimental dances of agency. Mm-hmm. But that comes to an end in science with finished science, which can be kind of detached from this process, mm-hmm. detached from the human beings who've made it. And then finished science can be fed back into future practice, mm-hmm. as a way of short-circuiting these dances of agency. So if I want to build a dam, I don't, just start trying this, trying that, trying something else. I can just about calculate everything that I want to do, right? And this way of kind of short-circuiting the dance of agency is what characterizes modernity. And what we're all worried about these days is the kind of dark side of these shortcuts, right? That we've learned how to dominate the world through the use of science, but at the same time, we precipitate all these unintended side effects and disasters. Global warming being the obvious example, I think.
But how would poiesis prevent these side effects? I mean, why is that better?
Well, I think you have to look at examples, right? I haven't got any kind of cure for global warming that I can examine as an example. But the point of the book that I've been writing is to look at a lot of examples and try to contrast what happens in this kind of enframing way of addressing the world and a poetic way of doing it. And generally, it's kind of obvious that the enframing way is the thing that's precipitating disaster. In the example I just went through for you, right? The point of the poetic way of going on was to try and do something about the disasters that this dominating way of building a dam had already precipitated. It's intended as a kind of antidote to the disasters of modernity.
Okay, and then I stopped with another, I mean, trying to link the two presentations. So where, I mean, if you had to put complexity science, let's say Santa Fe's complexity science, you know, I mean, or I mean one, I mean you can choose any of the seven that Fabrizio presented, or anyone you wanted, even if it's outside of the seven, I don't know. Would you put complexity science in the enframing or in the poiesis side? I mean, I know that cybernetics belongs more to poiesis, but Santa Fe is not really cybernetics. I mean, I don't know. What do you think about this complexity politics, which is, I mean, the main topic of the seminar, actually?
I think of complexity as being a different paradigm from the paradigm of, modern physics, modern chemistry, modern biology. It's producing a different kind of vision of the world, very often using different methods, different mathematics, from the vision of the world produced by classical physics, say. And it's the vision of the world that goes with this kind of pattern of poetic action that I've been trying to talk about now. So, complexity science in its different ways helps us to grasp the world as being full of exceedingly complex, wicked systems. It gives us something to hold on to when we're trying to understand those aspects of the world.
And an example, just to finish, an example of complexity science that you have in mind is what, cellular automata? I remember that you liked.
Yeah, I really like cellular automata, just because they show what Steve Wolfram's motto, exceedingly complex behavior from exceedingly simple rules. These are very simple determinists. Anybody can write down a cellular automaton and see what it does, and yet some of them are just totally unpredictable. It's a beautiful model of what the world might be like for people like me, who tend to think scientifically about it.
Okay, so I stop here, even I have many, many questions. But okay, so on the chat, let me choose. Actually, since we are discussing, maybe Fabrizio, maybe you have a question so I can read the chat during your question?
Okay. Thank you, Andy. It was very interesting. First, it's a very simple question. The text that we have read is one of the chapters of your future book.
No.
No?
No, I mean the example is treated at much more length than the book. Yeah.
Okay, and then what do you think of Christopher Langton and more generally artificial life? Because they did have some kind of they had the same kind of discourse that you describe for the English cyberneticians when they talk about the little simulations of life that they have, and they say, I'm surprised by what the simulation is going to do next, and that's why they talk about artificial life, some literally and some almost literally. So what do you think, and what do you think of their ontology? Because actually one comment that I wanted to give is to make is that you are one of the rare social scientists who managed to take out something non-reductionist from cybernetics or complexity, which many other social scientists come up to criticize as reductionist. You see what I mean? So it's interesting that you take precisely I know less the English tradition, so I learned new stuff. But do you think, and this is another question, do you think there is a strong difference between Pasque, Beer, Ashby, and Wiener, McCulloch, Pitts, etc.? And if there is this big difference ontologically, politically, where do you situate it? So two questions, artificial life and the distinction between the two cybernetics.
Yeah, the answer to the first question is easy. I mean, I like artificial life. In my early work in the history of science, I became fascinated by the idea that the world is a kind of place of emergence. And by emergence, I just meant, you never know what's going to happen next. So it's like talking about wicked systems and having to try to get to grips with them. And that's what fascinated me about British cybernetics to begin with, that it thematized this not knowing what's going to happen next. And of course, that's exactly what artificial life does. And as far as I know, they're constructing these amusing little systems that are always becoming something new. Maybe they only become something new in a rather kind of limited fashion, right? That would be something that wasn't so great from my point of view. Whereas, Wolfram's cellular automata just continually throw up unpredictable behavior. But artificial life is definitely in the same space, right? And you found plenty of Englishmen doing artificial life, in Sussex and things like that. The difference between American cybernetics and British cybernetics, it's a very different kind of feeling. Technically, Ross Ashby's homeostat was the key device for British cybernetics, which it never was for the Americans. The Americans, the Macy conferences, the people who went to those conferences were very keen on establishing their scientific credentials. They all made fun of Ross Ashby and Greg Walter when they went there, tried to make fun of them. American cybernetics has got this kind of very grim feeling to it, whereas British cybernetics was a kind of amateurish, literally amateurish way of going on. It didn't have any institutional support, which meant it evolved open-endedly in all sorts of interesting directions. That's what makes it so interesting for me. You've got psychiatry and brain science, but you also have the arts. And I guess I would say that, because of this interest in exceedingly complex systems, British cybernetics was about, practical projects in the world. it was less about doing kind of conventional calculations and understand. But you, in the history of British cybernetics, you find all these wonderful, amusing, entertaining, and original, and possibly important real-world projects that I wrote about in my book.
And then it was washed away like all the counterculture in the 70s then.
It wasn't washed away. I mean, there are still all these things left. They're just not recognized as part of a unitary paradigm the way they were in the 60s. So, you know, the AMP that I was just talking about is a classic bit of cybernetics. It's very important. It's happening in the world. But, you know, people don't associate it with anti-psychiatry or robot art or anything like that. It's the paradigm has been shattered.
Okay, and so we have several questions, and since you mentioned emergence, which is a central notion, you know, in complex systems, so Mohamed Charkawi asks if poiesis is another word for saying emergence without using it. That's one of his questions.
Emergence is a point about the world, that things are continually happening that we don't expect. A brutal sense of emergence. Poiesis is a way of being in the world, us human beings acting. If we're the masters of the universe and it never surprises us, we can dominate it and we build these enormous dams and we block up rivers. That's what Heidegger called enframing. If we recognize that we live in the presence of emergence, we have to be light on our feet and adaptive. That looks very di different, and that's what Heidegger called poiesis.
Yeah, I like, I mean, in some sense, it's also what Morisot, you know, Baptiste Morisot, I told you, I
Yeah.
told him, but nothing in English for the moment, as far as I know. He said that for complex systems, by what he meant, actually, exceedingly complex systems in your categories, the only policy possible, possibly, is delicacy. I mean, you have to be soft, you have to be, I don't know. On these systems, and I like this. I mean, I feel that this definition is quite interesting. He uses that about bees and okay, and pollinators and all that stuff. Okay. Another question by Roberta Rafaela is so thanks for the interesting talk. And so, has our Earth always been so complex, or is more complex in last decades? What would you say about that?
I don't have a measure of
I
complexity.
think so.
I mean, you know, what I would say was that through almost all of history of the human race, the wickedness, the complexity of the world has been obvious. You know, people have known they weren't in command of nature. It's only in like the 100 years since the scientific revolution, say, that we here in the West have come to think that we're in charge and we can act in this enframing fashion. So, you know, it's thinking the world isn't complex is the big mistake that characterizes modernity from that angle.
And another question is, can we see the results? Or actually, I don't understand very well the question. So maybe if Mieke de Moor apparently wants to speak out exactly, I mean, because can we see the results of science as one of the agents in the dance of agency? And how should science then be conceptualized to function as only one of the agents? So I don't know, maybe
Yeah.
you are the specialist of the dance of agency. So maybe, do you understand the question?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, that I today I was trying to draw attention to this, dance of agency in terms of this kind of material performative back and forth. If you want to think about knowledge, you have to understand it as being bound up in this kind of performative back and forth, which is precisely what I documented in my book, The Mangala Practice, years ago. I go on about the kind of performative aspects of ontology, because that seems to be the thing that we find it hard to talk about. I'm continually trying to attract people's attention to that, and they typically want to go back to talking about knowledge. So it's the skeleton that I was trying to draw attention to. But knowledge doesn't run the show. It's not in command. we don't have to believe it's true. We have to understand it as possibly productively bound up with performative dances of agency.
Okay, and is there any aspect of life that is not exceedingly complex when we start knowing more about it? Simplicity, just because we don't delve enough into any subject in some sense. It's not sort of an ontological property, but a stance. I think that this is what Marco Church means.
I think it's important that we are continually trying to make the world dual, as I tried to explain before. The point of engineering is to produce an object like this computer in front of me that doesn't act like a wicked system. I just sit in front of the computer and, you know, I connect to this meeting, I type papers and things like that. So it doesn't seem like a wicked system. There's a light over here, I can switch it on and off. I'm leaning on my desk, which I do every day. It's very reliable. It's not a wicked system. But everything goes wrong in the end, you know, computers especially. If you try and plug yourself into a network you've never been. Yeah.
Way of dealing with wicked systems.
Right. Oh, yeah. You know, so the wickedness kind of breaks through every now and then. But we manage to make the world seem non-wicked a lot of the time. That's what a lot of action in the world is about. You know, my house is still standing. It's several hundred years old. Mm-hmm. It's still standing because people keep repairing it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so I had maybe, we have just 1 minute left. I want always to stop really at 12:30. So there is one point maybe to end up. You distinguish, I mean, one way of distinguishing is this maximizing interaction or minimizing. Okay, science tries to minimize it, while you want to act with in cybernetics. However, you know, my image of taming the tiger. For example, when science tries to understand matter, you end up in CERN doing particle physics, and this is not a way of minimizing the interaction with matter. I mean, it's really transforming completely matter to purify it and to to tame it in ways that you can really do particle physics. And the matter you find inside the CERN and these particle accelerators is, I mean, you cannot say that you're minimizing the interaction with matter. So what, I mean, for me, it's not very, I mean, it's quite counterintuitive, this idea of minimizing the interaction with science.
Yeah, I mean, that was Gordon Pask's phrase. It's not mine.
Okay.
But you know, your image of minimizing and maximizing, the experiment at CERN is set up in a very precise way to bring out a very specific aspect of what happens in the world of elementary particles. Mm-hmm. And even when I was kind of writing about the history of particle physics, or was one, you know, in the 1970s, actually a lot of the data processing at CERN consists of throwing out data. You know, you throw out, you keep one event in 10 to the 9, right? I think, you know, speaking English, you know, in a kind of non-precise way, throwing out everything apart from one part in 10 to the 9 is minimizing interaction, right? And maximizing interaction would be to walk into the cage and start wrestling with the famous lion in your example, you know, try playing a game with it or pulling its tail and see what happens, you know. And an experimental sense. Particle physics is not experimental like that.
Like in somehow in AMP there is no concept, there is no a priori conceptualization, while at CERN every gesture that is made is highly theorized before, even if it's an experiment itself, but you have to conceptualize every part of the experiment, while in AMP, in your example of Colorado, if I understood it well, at the very beginning it was by chance. The flood was an accident, the first flood.
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Thank you.
Okay, so I promise to end in time. So thanks a lot, Andy. So we're really very happy to have you here with us. Hopefully we'll have for the discussion on next Monday. So I thank everyone of the, we are almost 40 to hear and to discuss. And so we meet again next Monday to discuss with Jean-Pierre Dupuis and Thomas Turnbull about second order cybernetics or cybernetics and complexity. So this should be interesting for you too, Andy.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
So thanks, everyone, and bye-bye, Andy. See you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Very good.
See you. Bye-bye. Always difficult to quit. Hein?
Yeah.
je mets fin à la réunion pour tous, OK?
Ah, c'est toi. OK.
Yeah.
So we have...
Bye-bye.
Oh, thanks.
Bye-bye, Fabrizio.
Bye.
Wait for your answers to my mails. Good luck with your book. Bye-bye.
OK. Bye-bye, Pablo. How do I get out of this?